Well, good evening. Welcome back to those who were here this morning, and welcome to those who were not. And for the sake of those who were not here, this is actually part two of the topic of forgiveness. And so I'm going to try to give you about a one-minute review. We start out talking about forgiveness, that we're all in need of forgiveness on one side or the other, because we've all been wronged and we all wrong others. And that's not something that's going to stop right now, not until we see our Savior face to face. But that's where the topic of forgiveness comes in. And whether you're on the side of offering forgiveness or on the side of receiving forgiveness, there's a deep work that has to take place in your heart. And so much of the time, what we hear about forgiveness stops short of doing that work. And we say the words, "I forgive you," but it really doesn't have much impact, and not much changes. And so we've been taking a dive into looking at forgiveness a little bit deeper. And a couple of the things that I said this morning is forgiveness doesn't excuse. It actually blames. It places blame where blame belongs, and then it releases them from the penalty of it. And I also said that in the deep work of receiving forgiveness, we have to not only receive the accusation, we have to receive the release from the debt. And we can get stuck in both places. Oftentimes it's very difficult to receive the full accusation. We somehow want to minimize it and not make it quite as bad as what it really is. And on the other side, so often we don't receive the release, and then we stay stuck in self-condemnation and wonder why we can't forgive ourselves. So, this morning, focus primarily on receiving forgiveness. This evening, we're going to talk about the other side. We're going to talk about offering forgiveness and the deep work that has to happen inside the heart to offer forgiveness to someone who's wronged us. When I've been wounded or wronged by someone, there's a deep work that I must do if I'm going to ever get to the place of having a heart attitude of forgiveness. And I've said a phrase several times this morning, you'll hear it several times this evening: it's not easy to do. It's easy to say, but it's not easy to do. We've been wronged, and there's anger in our hearts. There's anger against the wrong and anger against the person who could so easily sin against us. And we feel self-righteous in that anger. And it invites us to arrogance and contempt. We want payback. We want revenge. And the process of having to face all that's inside of us can be infuriating and unnerving. It isn't fair. You were the one wronged. You'd been wronged, and your heart cries out for revenge. And you want the offender to pay for the wrong that they've done. We can all identify with that, can't we? We've all been there. doing the deep work in the heart is much easier when the offender faces a wrong and grieves over what they've done. But even if the offender does not face the wrong, we still need to do a deep work to come to a place of having a heart attitude of forgiveness. God calls us to forgive, regardless of the response of the offender. Yet the full benefit of forgiveness is not realized unless the offender faces the wrong in humility and repentance. So what happens if I don't do the work of forgiveness in our heart when we've been wronged? It puts up a wall in our hearts that's impossible to penetrate. It shuts the offender out of relationship, and it punishes the offender. It's an act of revenge. And it bonds with others negatively. It bonds with those who will listen and agree on how much the offender should be punished. The bonding that occurs is over vindication and payback rather than anything that's edifying and caring. And it eats away at the heart of the one holding on to the unforgiveness. The results of unforgiveness, bitterness, resentment, rage, malice, and the prison of living with a hard heart. We're going to watch a movie clip, and in it, the man in this clip is the one who has been wronged. And I want you to notice and think about what's going on inside of his heart.
What do you want?
Oh, sorry. I brought you your supper.
All right, just leave it there. Is there something else?
What's that you're doing?
I am testing the nitrate levels of a local tomato.
Why?
Possibly interest you.
Well, enjoy your supper. Mm. Walter, what do you propose we should do if we get through the epidemic?
I have no idea. But I don't think any good will come of always talking about a situation that we should do much better to forget.
But you don't forget.
Please, I really must work.
Won't you listen to what I have to say?
All right, if you insist.
It's just today, having been at the convent with those nuns.
What have they done, converted you?
No. They spoke of you. It made me feel...
What? It made you feel what?
I think I've been afraid of you.
Well, you should have been. Excuse me if I can't work, I'm going to bed.
I know you're angry at me, but if we could just try and talk about...
Honestly, I don't understand you. What is it that you want from me?
Perhaps I just want us to be a little less unhappy.
You're mistaken in thinking that I'm unhappy. I have far too much to do here to think of you very much at all.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say. I feel useless.
What do you propose that I do about
that? For God's sakes, Walter, will you stop punishing me? Do you absolutely despise me?
No, I despise myself.
Why?
For allowing myself to love you once.
The wall of unforgiveness. It shuts the offender out, and it eats away at the heart of the one holding on to the unforgiveness. So how do we get rid of this wall of unforgiveness? We can't just say the words, "I forgive you," and something magical happens inside our heart. There's a deep work that we must do in our heart. And again, I'm going to say, it's not easy. We were the one wronged. And yet, we're the ones who have to face what's going on inside of our own heart. It doesn't seem fair. So what is this deep work that I have to do in my own heart? Ephesians 4:31 and 32 says, "Get rid of all bitterness, rage, and anger, brawling and slander, along with every form of malice. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you." Well, let's talk about what's this deep work that I have to do in my heart in order to get to the place where I even want to offer forgiveness. We have to start by facing that wall of unforgiveness in your heart. Admit the garbage that's in your heart, all the bitterness, the rage, the anger, the brawling, the slander. When you've been wronged, can you recognize any of these things messing around inside of you? Of course you can. It's human nature. We want justice. We want payback. And we want the wrongdoer to be punished for wronging us. The rub is that when we've been wronged, it also reveals the garbage and the wrong in our own heart. We not only desire justice, we want revenge. We want more than just justice. We want to see them pay greater than the wound that they inflicted on us. Genesis 4 tells us the story of Cain, who killed his brother Abel. And the Lord came to Cain and said that his brother's blood was crying out to him from the ground. And he placed a curse on Cain and said that he would be driven out of the land and he'd be a restless wanderer on the earth. And Cain responded that that was more than he could bear. And he said, "Whoever finds me will kill me." The Lord responded to him and said, "Not so. Anyone who kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." It was just a few short generations after Cain, that one of Cain's descendants, Lamech, wrote a poem. And in it, it said this: I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech 77 times. Lamech was saying that his heart was filled with revenge toward a young man who wronged him. And he was going to get revenge. But he was not going to just get even. He was not going to pay back the revenge even just 7 times greater than what had been done to him, like what would happen to Cain. No, he was going to go way over the top and pay him back 77 times. Our heart wants revenge when we've been wronged. So, another part is revoking the revenge. Revenge is about payback. When we feel wronged and hurt, there's something that rises up inside of us and wants to hurt back the one who wronged us. It really isn't about wanting justice. We want more than that. We're infuriated that someone would wrong us, and we want them to pay dearly for what he cost us. We want to hurt him more than he hurt us. We don't just want to hurt him as much as we do, him to hurt as much as we do. We want to maximize his pain. Remember when Jacob deceived Esau, stole his blessing from his brother? It says Esau cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry. Can you imagine what was going on inside of Esau's heart? He pleaded to his father to bless him as well. But when he realized that Jacob had received the entire blessing, there was nothing left for him. It said Esau lifted up his voice and wept. A bitter cry. He'd been cheated by the deceiver. And now he was very bitter. Esau was wronged, and now his heart was filled with thoughts of revenge. Verse 41 of chapter 27 says, Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing for which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. Whenever we've been wronged, there's a great opportunity for bitterness and resentment to grow in our heart. And then we want payback. But not just payback in proportion to what's been done to us, but payback that goes way beyond the wrong done to us. We want revenge. When Rebekah heard about Esau's plan to kill Jacob, she told Jacob with these words, Behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. When we've been wronged, we foolishly think that somehow revenge will make us feel better about what happened to us. We want to comfort ourselves with revenge. But unforgiveness is the poison we drink, hoping someone else will die. We want to comfort ourselves by killing someone else. But instead, we end up destroying ourselves through the bitterness of unforgiveness. Peter, in 1 Peter 3, teaches us a very different way. It's trusting God as the source of my identity and well-being. He says, do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult. But how do I do that when I've been wronged and my heart cries out for payback? I must have a source of trust that goes beyond a trust in my own ability to adequately deal with the wrong done to me by upping the ante and attempting to dish out more pain than what was unfairly given to me. Let's read that passage in 1 Peter 3. I'm going to start at verse 8. Finally, all of you, live in harmony with one another. Be sympathetic. Love as brothers. Be compassionate and humble. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. For whoever would love life and see good days must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from deceitful speech. He must turn from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are attentive to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who's going to harm you if you're eager to do good? But even if you should suffer for what is right, you are blessed. Do not fear what they fear. Do not be frightened. And here's the key. But in your hearts, set apart Christ as Lord. He has to be my source for my well-being and for dealing with justice on his terms and in his time. I must set apart Christ as Lord in my heart. In other words, I need to entrust the situation and my own well-being to Jesus. He has to become the source of my life that gives me significance and the security of being loved, even when I'm wronged. If we go back to chapter 2, we have a picture of this modeled by Jesus. It says, when they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, and here it is again, instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Do you see where our source has to be? Otherwise, my heart's going to cry out for payback. Now, this was introduced as a marriage conference, and we talked earlier this morning about, yes, forgiveness applies very much in all of our marriages, because we will be wronged, and we will wrong our spouses even when we do not want to. We're going to be on both sides of being wronged or wrong. Well, I happened to skip 7 verses because I started at verse 8. Do you know what those 7 verses are about that I skipped between Jesus' example and not repaying evil with evil but setting apart Christ as Lord? First 7 verses of chapter 3, they're on marriage. Isn't it interesting that they're sandwiched right in between that? So I need to trust God as a source of our well-being and identity, and that frees me from unhealthy attachments. Well, another part is I need to revise my source of trust then. Who do we trust in when we don't trust in God? Or what do we trust in when we don't trust in God? I like the way Jeremiah says it in Jeremiah 17. He says, this is what the Lord says. Cursed is the one who trusts in man, who depends on flesh for his strength. When do I trust in man? when I'm trusting in myself to take it into my hands, or when I'm trusting in you to come through for me in ways that I need you to come through for me. Either way, I'm trusting in man. Cursed is the man who trusts in man, who depends on flesh for his strength, whose heart turns away from the Lord. He will be like a bush in the wastelands. He will not see prosperity when it comes. He will dwell in the parched places of the desert, in a salt land where no one lives. You get a picture of how desolate that is? It's a lonely, isolated place. And when prosperity is there, I won't even see it. I'll miss it. But blessed is the man who trusts in the Lord, whose confidence is him, is in him. He will be like a tree planted by the water that sends out its roots by the stream. It does not fear when heat comes. It still does. Its leaves are always green. It has no worries in a year of drought and never fails to bear fruit. So think about the results of when I have misplaced trust. I have misplaced trust when it's in man, either myself to take care of it by myself, or trusting in you to make it okay for me. Then we need to rediscover the image bearer in the one who wronged you. When we're wronged, we shrink the one who wronged us to the size of what he did to us. The greater the offense, the smaller they become to us. Our wounds reduce our vision to defining the one who wronged us as nothing more than or nothing but. And we begin to see them as the wrong they did rather than as someone who did wrong. We no longer see them as an image bearer designed to love others who's also stained with sin. We simply see them as wrong. They become sin in our eyes. When we diminish him to less than the image bearer he is, our hate begins to rise and it gives birth to the bitterness, rage, and anger. We look down on them with contempt and can't see beyond desiring payback and revenge. At that moment, we are trusting in man. We're trusting in our own ability to somehow provide a measure of justice. Plus, we're trusting in our own ability to bring comfort to ourselves through revenge. It's clearly a misplaced trust that leaves our heart in a lonely, howling wasteland. But when we lift our eyes to see God's love and care in the midst of our pain, we begin to see the image bearer in the one who wronged us. Remember Joseph? Joseph's brothers had anger and hatred in their heart towards Joseph because Dad loved Joseph more than he loved them. And the longing for the love of a father drives them towards hatred and malice. It says they could not speak peacefully to Joseph. Those words must have been pretty mean and cruel. Joseph had a dream about his brothers bowing down to him. And after Joseph shared the dream with his brothers, they hated him even more. They hated him so much that they planned to kill him. And they ended up selling him into slavery rather than killing him. And then schemed up the story to tell Dad about how some wild animal must have killed him. Trouble didn't stop there for Joseph. He continued to experience tremendous wrong against him at the hands of others. But I'm going to fast forward over much of that to Joseph meeting up with his brothers years after they plotted to kill him but instead sold him into slavery. It's later in the story that we get a glimpse into what it was like for Joseph. His brothers reflected back on what they had done, and they said, "We saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we did not listen." Can you imagine the fear and the terror that Joseph was feeling? Not only were his brothers mean to him, they were going to kill him. And they did sell him into slavery. And Joseph begged them not to do it. But they didn't listen. Many years later, when Joseph's brothers came to Egypt to buy grain because of the severe famine in the land, Joseph saw beyond the wrong done to him by his brothers to God's salvation in the midst of and in spite of the wrongs. Joseph's deep awareness of God's love and provision was so much greater than the evil that his brothers had done to him. As a result, Joseph's heart was free to love. There was not a hint of desire and revenge. He only wanted to bless the ones who wronged him. Furthermore, Joseph didn't want them to beat themselves up for what they'd done. Yes, it was evil, but God worked it for good. He brought salvation out of it. Joseph said, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life." Additionally, when Joseph sent his brothers on their way, he specifically said, "Do not quarrel on the way." It would be so easy for them to start pointing the finger at each other. Reuben could have easily said, "I told you so, I told you not to do this," but you wouldn't listen. In fact, he did say that earlier. And Joseph heard him. But Joseph was seeing beyond the details of the wrong done to him. He was seeing the love and provision of God in the midst of the evil and wrong. Because of that, Joseph's heart was soft and tender towards his brothers. He had so much love and compassion for him that he was having a hard time to keep from bursting into tears. And when he finally revealed himself to his brothers, he no longer held the tears back. He wept loudly, so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and they weren't even in the room. When we begin to see beyond our own suffering for the wrongs that have been done against us, we can start to have compassion. It's just a very small taste of what Jesus experienced in a very big way on the cross when he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And that brings us to the next point. Remembering God's forgiveness of you. I said earlier that when we lift our eyes to see God's love and care in the midst of our pain, we begin to see the image bearer in the one who wronged us. We begin to see someone who shares our faulty humanity, bruised, like us. Faulty, like us. He's fragile, like us. He's a failed human being, not unlike myself. We also begin to see beyond the wrong that was done to us. We see a loving God who provides for us in the midst of our pain. And I would imagine that this happened for Joseph as well, based on how he was relating to his brothers when they came to Egypt. This whole process happened over a period of many years for Joseph. And I would guess that Joseph did some reflecting of his own, not only of how he was mistreated, but also about some of the things that were amiss inside of his own heart that needed to be addressed. Back when he was 17 years old and was experiencing such cruelty from his brothers, he was not entirely innocent himself. He was likely pretty arrogant and cocky, as he knew he was the favored child. And he probably took some delight in his dreams about his older brothers bowing down to him. Really, all that we're told is his father rebuked him for saying this. An honest look inside will always reveal that there are things going on inside of us that we are in need of God's forgiveness for. Remember Simon the Pharisee? We talked in greater detail this morning, but I'll recap it a little bit. Simon the Pharisee, who had Jesus over for dinner, he sat in judgment of Jesus because he was thinking inside of himself that if Jesus really was a prophet, he'd know what kind of woman this was. She was a sinner. And he wouldn't be letting her cry at his feet and wipe them. And after Jesus told the story to Simon about the two people who owed money to the moneylender, one a small sum, one a larger sum, but neither could pay it back, so the moneylender forgave the debts of both. And after asking Simon which one would love the moneylender more, Jesus stated the principle that we talked quite a bit about this morning. He who has been forgiven much loves much. And he who has been forgiven little loves little. Simon did not have much love in his heart. Not because he needed to be a greater sinner to have more to be forgiven for, but because he was blind to his own sin, which was also worthy of God's righteous judgment. He just needed to see the sin in his heart and lift his eyes to receive. But his own arrogance blinded him to his own sin. So when we're willing to take the hard look inside, and we'll see that we too are in desperate need of God's forgiveness. So then we begin to see we're all in the same boat. We're in desperate need of God's forgiveness. It's then that we can receive forgiveness from God. And it's then that we can begin to understand what it means to start walking toward a heart that can offer forgiveness. We now get a little deeper look at the verse we started out with this morning. Bear with each other and forgive whatever grievances you may have against one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. It's Colossians 3:13. And then Ephesians 4:32. Be kind and compassionate to one another, forgiving each other, just as in Christ God forgave you. And in the Lord's Prayer, we read, forgive us our debts, as we also have forgiven our debtors. Forgiven people love others. And forgiven people forgive others. And then we need to desire good for the one who wronged you. Joseph wanted his brothers to partake in God's blessing, and he warned them about turning their guilt into self-contempt or blaming each other. Instead, he encouraged them to look at the bigger picture of how God was bringing salvation out of what they intended for evil. He told them to get their father and return to Egypt, and he would provide for them. And he blessed them by providing food, money, clothes, and the good things of Egypt. Instead of repaying evil with evil, Joseph's heart was now ready to pay evil with good. Back to 1 Peter. Do not repay evil with evil or insult with insult, but with blessing, because to this you were called, so that you may inherit a blessing. And finally, we need to go the distance. We need to keep doing the work of forgiveness for the sake of my own heart and for the sake of the one who did me wrong. This is a process that's ongoing. I will continually have to face what's going on inside of me. Forgiveness doesn't happen just in a point in time. I can't just say that I forgave her 10 years ago as though that's all there is to it. There's always more to see about the depth of the wrong against me, and there's more to see about the depth of the mess inside of me in the context of the wrong that was done to me. Furthermore, I will be wronged again, even by someone who's trying not to wrong me or fail me. So what do I do with that? When Jesus taught on forgiveness, Peter said, "Lord, how many times shall I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to 7 times?" Peter probably thought that he was being generous in the suggestion that you forgive someone up to 7 times if they continue to wrong you. But Jesus said, no, not 7 times, but 77 times. This was not a lesson by Jesus to illustrate the limits of forgiveness, where we finally get to a point where we reach the limit, 77 times. Rather, it was a powerful illustration that contrasted forgiveness with what typically happens inside our hearts. Remember the poem of Lamech? "I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 7 times, Lamech 77 times." In stark contrast to the revenge of Lamech, Jesus says that we're not just to forgive someone 7 times, but 77 times. Oh my. My forgiveness is to go way over the top and keep forgiving. There's a deep work that must take place in my heart if I'm ever to forgive like God has forgiven me. I must recognize my tendency to act like Lamech and seek revenge. And doing the deep work in the heart to move toward having a heart of forgiveness is difficult. It involves letting go of the anger and the desire for revenge. It means desiring good for those who have harmed you. Jesus set aside his anger at the cross. He was justified, but he didn't demand justice. And he prays, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do." He has the heart attitude of forgiveness. Well, offering forgiveness is much more than simply saying the words, "I forgive you." In order to offer forgiveness, we've got to do the deep work in our heart. And once again, it's not easy. But remember, forgiveness does not excuse. It brings accusation against the offender. It's often easier to minimize the offense against you. "Oh, it's okay. It's no big deal." But when we minimize the offense, we settle for what I call this morning a weak forgiveness that lacks power. And weak forgiveness really isn't forgiveness at all. It's a counterfeit. To truly forgive, you must deeply face the offense against you, not lessen it. The wrong hurt. It did damage. Face it. Then choose to desire the ultimate good for them. that they would receive mercy and forgiveness for the wrongs they have committed. Two and a half years ago, I experienced the greatest pain that I've ever experienced. A young man by the name of Clark ran a stop sign at high speed and T-boned our Jeep. I was told that he was distracted on his cell phone. My precious wife of 45 years was killed. The state of Colorado pressed charges against Clark, and the court case lingered on for almost 2 years. And I requested the judge for permission to address Clark personally in court. The defense attorney fought that request and tried to prevent me from speaking at all. And all of his efforts and maneuverings were overruled by the judge. And I was finally granted the opportunity to address Clark May 31st, just this past year. I'm going to read to you what I read to the court. And it's going to be hard to read, and I know it's also going to be hard to listen to. But I want you to think about what we've been talking about and the process of forgiveness as I read it. This is what I wrote. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak. It matters to me what happens as a result of the tragedy that we experienced. It matters to me how I deal with it. And it matters to me how others deal with it. With that in mind, I'd like to try to answer the question, what would help me the most in dealing with this? First of all, I would like Karen, my precious wife of over 45 years, to be known and remembered for the beautiful woman that she was. Secondly, I would like the trauma of what I experienced to be heard with a measure of understanding. And finally, I would like to suggest what I believe could be the best possible good that could come out of such a costly mistake. So first of all, I'd like to give you a very small glimpse into the life of a very beautiful woman. As you can see from this picture, Karen was beautiful. Yet her real beauty was not what you see. It was what she was on the inside. Anyone who knew her. Would describe her as a gentle and loving woman who would light up a room as she entered simply by her presence. She was an extraordinary woman. But no one knew her gentle love more than I did, for I was married to her for over 45 years. We started off as high school sweethearts. Our relationship grew into something very special. I'm sharing a couple of pictures that give you a glimpse into our relationship, and I'd like you to notice the eyes. We enjoyed each other's presence and tackled life's challenges together as we both grew. In the last few years of our marriage, Karen often told me that she could describe our relationship with just one word: fun. So when we retired 2 years ago and sold our house in Alaska to downsize to a motorhome, we were embarking on a future of more adventure and connection. One of the reasons we were doing it was to spend more time with our grandkids. We arrived in Colorado on July 25th, 2016, to start moving into the motorhome. That first weekend, we went camping with our kids and grandkids. While camping, we found a great raspberry patch. So the next weekend we went back to pick raspberries in the mountains. It was August 6th. And we were on the way home from picking raspberries when the accident happened that threw my whole world upside down. My wife let out a scream as we realized that a large white truck was not slowing down for a stop sign. The scream was only half a scream as it was cut short by the violent impact. When everything stopped, the Jeep was on its side in the ditch of the road that the white truck was traveling, a significant distance from the road we were traveling on. The first thing that I realized was that my wife's lifeless body was hanging over me from her seatbelt and shoulder harness as the blood was flowing out of her head on me. I quietly called her name with no response. I was aware that I had two hurting and traumatized kids in the back seat, and I didn't want to alarm them more than they already were. Little Willa started screaming out in fear and pain, and I couldn't even turn enough to see her, let alone help her. Lily, my granddaughter, was sitting behind me and had a clear view of her grandma's lifeless body. She called out in a clear and strong voice and said, "Grandpa, are you okay?" It hurt that I couldn't reassure her, as I knew I wasn't okay. Somehow, I managed to get my cell phone out of my pocket and call my daughter, who was driving home from the raspberry patch with her husband, son, and mother-in-law. They were a few miles ahead of us. I don't remember all that I said, but I remember telling Heather that we were just in a terrible car accident, and I didn't know if Mom was alive. I managed to undo my seatbelt and crawl out the window. My grandkids and my kids and my grandson were some of the first on the scene, and they witnessed a terrible scene that produced its own trauma for them. When my daughter arrived, she promptly squatted down and held my hand as I sobbed for my wife, who I knew wasn't going to live. After what seemed to be a very long time, we were eventually transferred by ambulance to the hospital. My wife was flown to the trauma hospital in Lakewood while I remained in the Alamosa hospital. After 2 days in ICU, I was released early so I could go to Denver to be with my wife. She died of her injuries 9 days after the accident. She never regained consciousness. The pain was excruciating as I held her hand and watched her take her last breath. The heartache is beyond what most people can comprehend. It was at the trauma hospital that I met Clark's mom, who is here today, and several of her friends. I didn't know until then that Clark was flown to the same trauma hospital as Karen was. We talked, cried, and held hands as we prayed together. A few days later, Karen died. It is now a few days shy of being 1 year and 10 months since the accident. I still have many tears. Karen and I were very close and enjoyed being together, and now she's gone, never to return. We thought that we would have many more years together as we're very active and healthy. Healing from this trauma. Has been long and slow. I've often said that this is not like a broken bone that you heal from. It's more like an amputation that you learn to live with. Yes, there is healing after an amputation, but the loss of a precious part of you is always gone and will never return. I have known that I must fully face the pain of my loss. It can be tempting to jump into distractions meant to avoid the pain on one side or enter self-pity on the other side. but my path has been clear from the beginning. I must be willing to feel the pain and face the impact of my loss. Otherwise, my own heart would become a little more deadened and perhaps a little more hardened. Healing from this trauma requires that I face the darkness of the loss on the one hand, while seeking to continue to live life with gratitude and vitality on the other hand. It's not easy. I am blessed to have a very caring community and family who love me and have walked this painful journey with me. I hope Clark can experience that as well. I'm grateful to see his mom support him, and I hope that he has extended community that is willing to come alongside of him as well. The mistake of failing to stop for a stop sign has been a costly one for me and for my family. I would like to suggest what I believe could be the best possible good that can come out of such a costly mistake. I desire good for each of the victims of this accident, and I desire good for Clark as well. So I'd like to try to explain what I mean by this. I have often thought of what it would be like if I were the one who failed to stop at the stop sign. It could have been me. I think that probably every one of us in this room has probably run through a stop sign at some point in their life. I have. I've been distracted by conversation to the point where I missed seeing a stop sign and didn't even know it until someone pointed it out to me. It didn't have tragic and costly consequences. It could have. So what if I was the one who ran the stop sign and caused devastating and painful consequences in the lives of many? What would be the best possible response from me after such a costly mistake? Well, I'll tell you when it wouldn't be. It wouldn't be a response that minimized it. If I viewed it simply as a traffic violation that the state is trying to pin on me, my heart would be uncaring. And worse, it would be hard and calloused. I would only be looking to avoid consequences. And as a result, I would not be free to care about others and love others well. The damage of the accident would only increase and do more damage to my own heart and to those who cross my path. So if I were the one who made the mistake, what would be a response by me that could lead to healing both for the victims and for my own heart? It would be to fully face the impact of what my mistake cost others, to let my heart grieve for the loss and to care for the victims and desire to do whatever I could to help them heal. Then good could come out of tragedy. The pain and the loss will remain, but good could result. It is with that in mind that I have offered forgiveness to Clark. Forgiveness doesn't minimize. It actually places blame where blame belongs. It would be an insult to offer forgiveness to someone who hadn't done anything wrong. Instead, forgiveness recognizes the wrong and chooses to relinquish any revenge or payback for the wrong. Forgiveness gives the gift of grace to someone who has done something wrong. It offers care instead of payback. It's being willing to live with the cost and seek to love. I realize that Clark's brain injury has likely resulted in him losing the sense of himself. Consequently, it could be difficult for him to process complex emotions. So first of all, I hope that he can regain a sense of himself and begin to feel normal again. I hope that Clark can begin to feel things like sadness, sorrow, and even heartache. It would mean that he's beginning to be more normal once again. I also hope that he can experience joy, gladness, and peace once again. If he can experience those emotions and begin to understand what they mean, he can also begin to care about others, including the victims of his mistake. So my hope is that Clark will eventually be willing to look at what his mistake cost me and many others. And in doing so, that he will let his own heart care so that he can be free of hardness and the devastating kind of pain, which will only increase his stress and slow his own healing. In contrast to a devastating kind of pain, an aching, caring heart will not increase stress. It will reduce it. Seeing good come out of tragedy is the thing that would help me the most. So what's the ultimate good that can come from all this? For Clark, it's for him to take ownership and responsibility for the mistake he made. That would open the door for him to begin to care about the victims and what this has cost them. It would also open the door for Clark to begin to see a path of freedom for his own heart. For the rest of us, it means that we would all be willing to look deeper into our own hearts and see how we're handling our pain and loss. Is it a direction that leads to a harder, more calloused heart? Or is it a direction that frees our heart to love, even in the midst of tremendous pain? The journey is painful and difficult, but worth the effort. I recognize that the things that I'm hoping for are things that cannot be demanded or required from anyone. I'm simply laying out my own desire with the hope that it will be heard and received. Thank you again, Judge Ruth, for the opportunity to speak. Thank you. Forgiveness, even when offered, isn't always received. When Jacob died, Joseph's brothers were afraid. They thought that Joseph might have been kind to them for the sake of Dad. But now Dad was dead. And they thought Joseph might turn on them with revenge now for the evil that they'd done to him. They didn't fully trust Joseph's forgiveness. So they made up a story. They told him how Dad told them to tell Joseph, "Please forgive the transgressions of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you." And rather than tell Joseph directly, they sent a message to him. They were afraid. When Joseph heard the message, he wept. Joseph had already forgiven them, but they did not fully trust it. And they didn't rest in the forgiveness that had been granted. It had already been given, but it wasn't fully received. When you've done the hard work of forgiveness and want to offer it, you also want it to be received. But it's not always fully received. And when it's not, your heart will ache. Joseph cried. When his brothers came to him, they repeated the message that they made up about Dad, saying to please forgive them. And Joseph responded by saying, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" Joseph understood that justice and vengeance belong to God. It's not our place to try to pay back evil for evil. Carrying out justice belongs to God. Our tendency is to go way over the top with our payback. Remember the poem of Lamech? But God's justice is right. So we must leave the carrying out of justice to God. Joseph continued and said to his brothers, "As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today." Joseph did not minimize or lessen the wrong. He blamed them and called it what it was. It was very wrong. It was evil, and that's how they intended it. They meant it for evil. But God meant it for good. God used it to bring salvation. Joseph saw a bigger picture than the wrong that was done to him. He'd already come to the place of having a heart of forgiveness. And he reassured his brothers by saying, "So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." And then these words, Joseph comforted them and spoke kindly to them. When we've done the full work of forgiveness in our heart, it will change the way we relate. We will have a heart of kindness that seeks to bring comfort to those who have wronged us, even when they haven't fully received the forgiveness that's offered. The work of offering forgiveness does not depend on the offender repenting. It's a work in the heart of the one who's been wronged. However, the full benefit of the forgiveness does not take place without repentance. Several years ago, I was working with a woman who was dealing with the pain of being sexually abused by her father over many years. And she worked hard and for quite a period of time, and one day she came to me and said, "You know, it'd be really good for my dad to receive forgiveness for what he has done." And she says, "I want to go back and talk to him." And she went back to her father, and they met together, and she brought up the topic. And she said, "Dad, do you remember?" And he said, and she mentioned some of the specific things. And he said, "Yes, I remember." And then she said, "Dad, it would be so good for you to receive forgiveness for what you've done." And he said, "Well, you know, it took two." Her father was not willing to receive and own the wrong that he had done without excuse. And so she left, came back to Alaska without her father receiving the gift of forgiveness. She offered it. It could have led to restoration of relationship. However, she did the work in her heart. And she carried in her heart a heart of forgiveness and love. Her heart ached, but she wasn't devastated because she wasn't depending on the response of her father. She'd done the work and had transferred her trust to God so that even if her father didn't receive the forgiveness, she was okay. Aching heart? Yes. Devastated heart? No. She longed for her father to own what he had done. But he didn't receive the accusation. Two years later, her father came to her and said, "Honey, the things that I did to you as a child were so wrong, and I'm so sorry." And through tears, he then named and owned what he had done. And they embraced and wept for the joy at the power of forgiveness. It was just a few days later that he invited Christ into his heart and received God's forgiveness. God is a God of forgiveness. He has the heart of forgiveness. It's freely offered to all. But all will not receive his forgiveness. Only those who humbly face their wrong and repent receive the full benefit of forgiveness. Andrew is going to pass out some of the points that were on the sheet. I think you have both this morning's and tonight's, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so For those of you who did not get a handout this morning, on it, I list some of the points of what's the work that has to happen in the heart when we're on the side of the one receiving forgiveness, and what's the work that has to have when we're offering forgiveness. And so in the first session, I showed a clip of a man that was receiving forgiveness from God and desiring to receive forgiveness from his wife. And there were no demands. He just expressed the hope that someday she would be able to come to a place where she could forgive him. And like you, those of you who saw that this morning, to think back on the sheet that you have and think about the points that are on your outline of what's the deep work that has to happen in order to get to that place in the heart. This evening, we looked at the other side. What does it mean to do the deep work in the heart to come to a place of offering forgiveness? And I'd like you to look over your handout and glance over the things that we've talked about. When the process of receiving and offering forgiveness is fully entered into, it's a beautiful thing that's transforming, both for the one giving and for the one receiving. And we're going to watch another clip. And in this clip, I'd like you to be thinking about the points that we talked about this evening, and they're on your sheet. So let's go ahead and play the clip.
He ain't gonna get it. Rescue, exposure, containment, extinguish.
Captain, can I see you for a minute?
Right now?
Yes, sir.
Something wrong?
Catherine's in the bay.
My Catherine?
Yes, sir.
Told you that you are a good man. You are. And if I haven't told you that I've forgiven you, I have. Told you that I love you. I do. Something has changed in you, Caleb. And I want what happened to you to happen to me.
It can.
Is it too late? Ask you to grow old with me.
So jump back to the night to love you find it's been in all the
life. So there's a deep work that has to take place in the heart in order for true forgiveness to take place. For the one who did the wrong, it's facing the wrong with no excuse. And that requires a letting go of pride, and it's very humbling. For the one who was wronged, it's letting go of the anger and the desire for revenge and replacing it with love for those who have wronged us. So what's more difficult to do? letting go of the anger and loving those who wronged us, or letting go of pride and humbly receiving mercy? In both cases, something has to die. And that's precisely what needs to happen. We're crucified with Christ. We crucify our anger. Crucify our pride. For I've been crucified with Christ. Something in us has to die so that we can receive at that level. So, is your experience of forgiveness anemic or powerful? It will depend on whether or not you're willing to do the work. So, thank you for the opportunity to let me share with you this evening.